ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, a look at the U.S. Supreme Court term that ended this week, then services to remember Melissa Hortman, the Minnesota State Assembly leader who was assassinated, and her husband, Mark. Sports as Wimbledon begins and questions about injuries as sports seasons grow longer. And a new album from the folk, punk, country artist Willie Carlisle, who plays half a dozen instruments.
I get to let them speak very simply and kind of see what they have to say about the words that I'm working with and about the melody that I'm working with.
But first we have our newscast. Thanks for being with us. It's Saturday, June 28, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Wan. Senate Republicans have released an updated version of huge spending and tax cut legislation containing much of President Trump's domestic agenda. This sets the table for votes on the measure less than a week ahead of the party's self-imposed July 4th deadline. As NPR's Elena Moore reports, GOP leaders are trying to persuade a number of party holdouts to support the bill.
Republicans hope to begin voting today, but there are still lawmakers with outstanding concerns, and the party can only afford to lose three votes. One issue has been changes to Medicaid, especially a proposal to slowly reduce and cap the tax that states can place on health care providers. Some lawmakers with big rural populations say that change could take away funds for hospitals that serve people without access to other care. The bill does create a fund of $25 billion spread out over several years to help those rural hospitals, but it's unclear if that will cut it for concerned senators. Elena Moore, NPR News, Washington.
The Supreme Court handed the Trump administration a major win yesterday, limiting the use of nationwide injunctions by federal courts. But as NPR's Anna Isaacs reports, the fate of the policy at the heart of the case, President Trump's executive order to end birthright citizenship, remains uncertain.
The justices did not rule on the merits of the order, which declares that children born in the U.S. to parents without legal status or on a temporary visa are not entitled to automatic citizenship. That order is still blocked for at least the next 30 days. After that, the order could go into effect in the states that have not challenged it. That means the rules for citizenship could differ state by state, which critics warn will lead to chaos and confusion. The Supreme Court has asked the lower courts to reconsider their broad rulings. In the meantime, there are also class action lawsuits in the works. The case's central question, whether denying birthright citizenship is constitutional, may come before the high court as soon as next term. Anna Isaacs, NPR News, Washington.
A funeral gets underway within the hour for Melissa and Mark Hortman. The Minnesota state representative and her husband were shot to death 2 weeks ago by a man authorities say had posed as a police officer. The same man is suspected of seriously wounding a state lawmaker and his wife in a separate shooting. Former President Biden and former Vice President Harris are expected to attend today's funeral. Catherine Richard of Minnesota Public Radio has more.
It's a private funeral at the Basilica of St. Mary in Minneapolis, but it's also being live streamed. We know that Governor Tim Walz and a family friend are speaking at the funeral, and former President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are expected at the funeral as well. The service will be a capstone on a shocking and tragic 2 weeks for Minnesotans.
Catherine Richard reporting. This is NPR News in Washington. Crowds gathered in the streets of Tehran today for the funeral of the head of the Revolutionary Guard and other top commanders killed during the 12-day war with Israel. Israel says it had targeted nuclear sites and killed 30 commanders and 11 scientists. The U.S.-funded Famine Early Warning Systems Network is back online. The website relaunched this week after going dark at the end of January when the Trump administration shut it down as part of what it said would be a review of all foreign assistance spending. NPR's Gabrielle Emanuel has more.
The system is known as FuseNet, and for the past four decades, it has provided detailed data about hunger hotspots, as well as future forecasts of famines and other humanitarian disasters. This data is used by governments and aid groups around the world. Tanya Boudreau is with FuseNet.
To see FuseNet back online again, to see the website emerge again from what was a very dark place, it's like seeing a light come back on, frankly.
She says they're rehiring staff. In the past, the U.S. spent just about $65 million a year on the system. Boudreau says the funding level going forward is still unclear. Gabriella Emanuel, NPR News.
Dozens of European Union lawmakers and other officials are defying a ban to attend Budapest Pride today to celebrate the LGBTQ plus community. The Hungarian government warns participants could go to jail. EU Commission Chief Ursula von der Leyen says marching for rights is a fundamental EU freedom. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. The Supreme Court gave President Trump several big wins yesterday, but the dissenting justices did not accept the rulings quietly, and groups opposed to several of Trump's executive orders have already filed lawsuits seeking workarounds. Amy Howe, co-founder of the SCOTUS blog, which covers all the cases before the Supreme Court, joins us. Amy, so good to have you with us in our studios. Thanks very much.
It's good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Let's begin with the decision to limit the powers of lower court justices from handing down nationwide injunctions, because there's several that had blocked several of President Trump's executive orders recently. Has the president suddenly been granted new executive powers?
He hasn't been granted new executive powers, but it will be much harder for federal district judges to block his agenda. And this is these nationwide injunctions, or universal injunctions, as Justice Amy Coney Barrett called it in her opinion for the Supreme Court yesterday, have been a thorn in the side for the president, both in this administration and in his prior one. Mm-hmm. And in between, they were a thorn in the side of the Biden administration, because with these universal injunctions, it meant that a plaintiff who was opposed to a law, or in particular to an executive order, which the current president, Donald Trump, has issued many of since he was inaugurated on January 20th, could go to a federal district judge. And in many cases, you could select which federal court you wanted to go to and pick one that you thought might be sympathetic and get a ruling that would block the administration from enforcing the order anywhere in the United States. And so it had kept the Trump administration from really implementing some of its agenda until the issue could make its way up to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court could step in.
I have to ask, there's typically a sense of deference among justices and mutual respect for one another, even as they may strongly disagree. But the exchanges that you could read in this decision were notably sharp, weren't they?
They were. The decision was by Justice Amy Coney Barrett, which was itself really sort of interesting because she is the second most junior justice on the court, and she's the most junior of the conservative justices. Many of us thought that because this was such a major opinion that it would be one that Chief Justice John Roberts would keep for himself. Mm-hmm. But she was very critical in particular of the solo dissent by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. And it's not unusual for the justices to criticize each other in their written opinions. Famously, a couple of years ago, Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Justice Elena Kagan, who are both liberal justices on the court, sort of exchanged barbs in a copyright case, of all things, involving an Andy Warhol print. But this one seemed particularly pointed.
Andy Warhol makes a lot of people exchange barbs. but go ahead.
Yeah. This one seemed particularly pointed and personal, in no small part because she mentioned Justice Jackson by name.
Yeah.
To a certain extent, she had to do that because there were two dissents. There was a main dissent by Justice Sonia Sotomayor, which Justice Jackson also joined. And then Justice Jackson had her own dissent. But, it seemed she devoted a lot of ink to it, and it seemed particularly stinging.
We should note and come back to the fact nothing in that decision gets at the underlying issue of ending birthright citizenship. Did anything in yesterday's ruling give you a sense of how the Supreme Court would vote when presented with that issue?
The Supreme Court was very clear that it was not deciding anything about the legality of the president's order ending birthright citizenship itself. There were some questions about birthright citizenship at the oral argument back in May. Justice Brett Kavanaugh, one of the conservative justices, really pressed John Sauer, who is the Solicitor General representing the Trump administration, asking the court to end these kinds of universal injunctions, about how it would work to have this executive order go into effect if the birthright citizenship order were to go into effect. But the court was very clear that it was not actually deciding this issue because the Trump administration hadn't asked it to.
You've been following the Supreme Court for two decades now.
Thanks, make me feel old.
Oh my gosh, some of us have been doing stuff longer than that. So no.
Yes,
welcome here. Well, let us tap your expertise. How interesting a term has this last one been, or is that an understatement?
It's an understatement. This court didn't have the kind of over and over again blockbuster rulings on the merits, cases in which the court heard oral arguments and then issued written opinions. But this was really an extraordinary term, and we could continue to get rulings from the court on its so-called emergency docket or shadow docket, these emergency appeals asking the justices to intervene and block lower courts' orders, like the kind of orders that we had in the birthright citizenship cases at the Supreme Court.
Amy Howe of the SCOTUS blog, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
The ceasefire declared by President Trump between Iran and Israel has been in place for less than a week. While missiles are on hold, the situation remains tense. The region has been hit by a series of conflicts since the start of Israel's war with Hamas in Gaza over a year and a half ago, and has at times sparked fighting in Lebanon, Syria, Yemen, and most recently Iran. Concerns reached an all-time high after the bombing of Iran's nuclear sites, as well as other targets by Israel and the United States, especially among countries in the region who stand to become collateral damage should fighting resume. Michael Waheed Hanna is Crisis Group's U.S. Program Director, focusing on U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East and South Asia. He joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
There's a ceasefire in place between Iran and Israel. How much confidence is there in the region in this agreement?
I think there's a lot of uncertainty. I think despite the triumphalism of President Trump and the Israelis, really maximizing their sense of what the military strike has achieved, there continues to be real uncertainty about the practical effect in terms of nuclear infrastructure. There's real questions about the stockpiles of highly enriched uranium. And perhaps most importantly, there is uncertainty about what Iran wants to do, what it will choose to do with its nuclear program. And as you mentioned, that means that the Gulf states, who are quite vulnerable to what happens in this conflict and yet aren't necessarily in charge of the trajectory of events, continue to be quite wary that this military confrontation will mean that they are collateral damage in the midst of this bigger fight.
How is Iran's nuclear program viewed in the region?
Negatively, of course. There has been real fear about Iran and Iran trying to become a kind of hegemon. As much fear as there's been about the nuclear program and where it might be going, there's also been fear about Iran's network of proxies who have been engaged in this war that has erupted in the region since October 7th, but that some of these proxies themselves have targeted the Gulf. And so there is real fear about Iranian intentions and actions, but many of these countries have decided in recent years that confrontation was probably not their best bet. And so we've seen a kind of mass movement toward rapprochement with Iran. And many of the Gulf countries have renormalized relations with Iran in an effort to open dialogue and to see if perhaps a less confrontational approach to their neighbor might bear better results.
The regional landscape has certainly changed since October 7, 2023, when Hamas attacked Israel, which, of course, triggered the conflict that still is going on. Are there concerns that a war between Israel and Iran could turn into a more protracted and lasting conflict?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the big fears was that U.S. entrance into the war, as we saw last weekend, might kick off a much broader escalation and kick off a war, again, that would target the Gulf, right? One of the key issues was how Iran would respond. At the end of the day, they responded in a very constrained, telegraphed fashion, I think, in an effort to minimize the possibility that they would either kill Americans or hurt American interests in such a way that could draw the United States into the war. But of course, it didn't have to be that way. And of course, there are real fears that Iran would perhaps target Americans, target American installations, and perhaps target the Gulf itself, oil infrastructure, the rite of passage through the Red Sea and the Strait of Hormuz. There are a variety of issues that were potential triggers for a much broader conflict. And of course, that is a big worry.
In the half a minute we have left, what does real long-term stability look like, or intermediate-term stability?
Yeah, I think it comes with an agreement. Donald Trump has suggested that he might talk to the Iranians and maybe there'll be an agreement, maybe not, but that he doesn't think there's necessarily a need for an agreement. And I think that's a mistake, if true. I think it's very clear that this kind of uncertainty will breed instability. It will create potential triggers for future conflict. Even Donald Trump himself speaking yesterday suggests that if the Iranians began to enrich again, that he would consider striking. And so without an agreement firmly governing what goes on in the Iranian nuclear program, I think it's a real cause for concern.
Crisis Group's Michael Wahid Hanna, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And you're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The Senate will be in session today to consider President Trump's sweeping tax cut and spending bill. The legislation would spend more money on defense and less on Medicaid and other programs that benefit lower-income Americans. Officials in Pakistan say a suicide bomber attacked a military convoy in the northwest part of the country, killing at least 8 soldiers. The bomber struck near the Afghan border, where several Islamist militant groups operate. And a new smoking ban goes into effect Tuesday in France. It will prohibit smoking in all parks, beaches, sports venues, and bus stops. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the NPR Wine Club, bringing people wines inspired by NPR shows. Whether purchasing a few bottles or joining the club, every purchase supports NPR. Available to adults 21 or older. NPRWineClub.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at Skoll.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Senate Republicans are still working to try to pass President Trump's big spending and tax cut bill. They hope to begin voting on it today. Republican leaders have been racing to persuade a number of party holdouts to support the bill, which contains much of Trump's domestic agenda. The president would like to sign it by July 4th. That is less than a week away. NPR political reporter Elena Moore joins us. Elena, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Scott.
And how close are Republicans to reaching a deal on this bill?
Well, Scott, I think it'll depend on how much they can get done today, or really how many outstanding issues Senate Majority Leader John Thune can resolve. He told reporters yesterday that the idea of bringing the bill to the floor today was, quote, aspirational, but that he would try. It's a tricky situation since there are still several lawmakers with outstanding concerns. And yes, Republicans have a majority in the chamber, but they can only afford to lose 3 votes.
What are senators still debating?
Well, simply put, there's a math problem. A key part of this bill would make Trump's 2017 tax cuts permanent. Those expire at the end of the year. But that is going to be really expensive. One way lawmakers are trying to offset some of those costs is by making changes to Medicaid. But that's created a slew of procedural and policy issues, especially over a proposal to slowly reduce and cap the tax that states can place on Medicaid providers.
What exactly are they concerned about?
Well, I mean, some senators with big rural populations say that that change would take away funds for hospitals that serve people without access to other care. The bill would create a fund of $25 billion to spread out over several years to help those rural hospitals. But that may not cut it for some senators, like, you know, Susan Collins of Maine, who has said that she wants that number much higher. Senator Tom Tillis of North Carolina has also been saying the idea of a fund doesn't solve all of his problems. He told reporters that he's run the numbers, and many of these proposed Medicaid changes could really hurt Americans across the country.
Blue states, purple states, red states, in our estimation, they're not going to be fiscally prepared to ramp it down. And some of that has to do with people. Some people have just a simplistic view, maybe haven't done the analysis that we have.
You know, he told me yesterday that he hasn't seen anything so far that would get him to a yes on this initial vote. But important to note that this bill specifically states both that the provider tax change and this fund would start in 2028, which is notably after the midterm elections.
And of course, elections have a way of adjusting plans.
Right.
Are any of the skeptical senators likely to be moved by an adjustment for politics?
Well, Tillis and Collins, who are both up for re-election next year, you know, that's in the mix for them. But they say this is bigger than that. This change could help them, but we don't know how they're going to respond. This is a tricky situation. I mean, Medicaid provides health coverage to 71 million low-income and disabled Americans, and it's just really popular. A recent poll from the health research organization KFF found that 3 in 4 Republicans support it. This bill, Scott, is far less popular.
Elena, if senators do come to an agreement, what then happens?
Well, I mean, they could hold an initial vote that would kickstart the process, but that's really not a speedy process. First, they need to debate the bill, and then they have to vote on amendments, and that whole shebang could very well stretch into Sunday. And then, of course, once the Senate passes the bill, it goes back to the House, which also has a slim majority. And as for timing, like you said at the beginning, Trump wants this bill at his desk by July 4th. But we should say that's a self-imposed deadline. And he even seemed to soften on that demand yesterday at a press conference at the White House. But the bottom line is that Trump wants to deliver on campaign promises he made, and this bill will do that.
NPR's political reporter, Elena Moore, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Various seed oils, including soybean, canola, and safflower, are sometimes known as the hateful eight by critics. Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. has said these oils are, quote, poisoning Americans. But as NPR's Maria Godoy found out, many health and nutrition researchers say those claims aren't supported by science.
Peek into any kitchen pantry and you're likely to run into a seed oil quickly.
My cooking oil here is canola oil.
That's nutrition scientist Caitlin Dow with the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and this is her pantry. Her seed oils aren't limited to a bottle. They're in lots of different packaged foods.
So here I have vanilla wafers, and this says vegetable oil, so it has palm oil and soybean oil.
There's a bag of popcorn with sunflower oil and some oat milk made with canola.
What you'll find is that most foods that you're going to get in a bag or a box are going to use seed oils as their oil.
That's because seed oils are cheap, shelf-stable, and neutral in flavor. So why are seed oils being vilified? Eric Decker is a food scientist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. He says one common criticism is that seed oils are refined using hexane, a chemical solvent that helps draw the most oil out of a seed. That hexane is removed as part of the processing.
But you end up with very small amounts left in the oil. Usually these amounts are less than one part per million.
Decker says these trace residue levels are too low to pose a health risk. But if you're concerned, you can avoid hexane by buying organic seed oils, which will be more expensive. Another common criticism is that seed oils promote inflammation. When we reached out to Secretary Kennedy, his team pointed us to the MAHA report, which says that seed oils contribute to imbalances of fatty acids that play, quote, a potential role in inflammation. He went further in this interview with Fox News last year.
Seed oils are one of the most unhealthy ingredients that we have in foods, and they are associated with all kinds of very, very serious illnesses, including body-wide inflammation.
Nutrition scientist Sarah Berry of King's College London says this knock against seed oils is based on a misunderstanding of how the body processes the fats in these oils.
Seed oils are particularly rich in the omega-6 polyunsaturated fats.
Our bodies convert omega-6s into chemicals that promote inflammation, which is important if you need to stop bleeding, for example, or help a wound heal. Critics argue that if you consume too much omega-6, you're going to end up with chronic inflammation, which can lead to chronic diseases.
Now, that all looks beautiful on a piece of paper, but it doesn't play out in real life. It doesn't play out in the human body, and there's randomized controlled trials consistently to support this.
One researcher who's spent decades studying fatty acids is Tom Brenna of the University of Texas at Austin. He is concerned that people eat way too many omega-6s in their diet from seed oils, but he says you shouldn't stop eating them altogether.
Some of the influencers are talking about getting rid of all the omega-6 in the diet. That would be a terrible idea. So make sure you say some omega-6 is absolutely required. The question is how much.
Brenna says he mostly sticks to olive oil, which he acknowledges is expensive. You can also look for seed oils that are labeled as high oleic. They have fatty acid profiles similar to olive oil.
Focus on a balanced diet. If you eat olive oil and fish, you will live forever.
The one thing everyone we spoke with agrees with is that we eat too much ultra-processed food. Nutrition researcher Christopher Gardner of Stanford Medical School says ultra-processed foods are a main source of seed oils in our diet. But these foods also tend to be high in salt, sugar, and fat.
So is it the junk food that's causing these health issues, or is it the seed oils? And I have always thought it's the junk foods, not specifically the seed oils.
He says if you're using seed oils to make a salad dressing or a stir fry that gets you to eat more vegetables, that's ultimately a win for health. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
And now to the stirring tones of BJ Lederman's theme music. It's time for sports. Cup of tea and fresh cut grass. It's time for Wimbledon, and Achilles tendon injuries in basketball seem to be on the rise. Sportcaster Howard Bryant joins us. Thanks for being with us, Howard.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Don't forget the strawberries and cream with Wimbledon, too. I'm addicted.
Oh, that's right.
It's a favorite.
You know that strawberries and cream very well, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. Not this year, though. I'm home.
All right. Well, let's begin to the women's tournament. Coco Gauff comes to Wimbledon after having just won her second Grand Slam championship at the French Open. She's 21 years old and is the second-ranked player in the world. Is she the favorite?
It's a great question. You would think that she very well could be. This was when she made her debut, and she shocked Venus Williams, who had won that tournament five times. And she's very comfortable on grass. You know, she's coming off a major championship. She plays exactly the type of game, although the serve isn't huge. But I think that when you watch her play, the level of confidence she has now having two majors. Let's not forget Aryna Sabalenka, whom she beat in Paris, who's also looking for her first Wimbledon. You're looking at Elena Rybakina, who's also won this tournament. Let's not forget the former number one Iga Swiatek, who's never gotten past the quarters here. A lot of good players. Women's tennis is a little bit more unpredictable than the men, but you've got two players that I think people do want to see again. You want to see the Sabalenka Gauff rivalry. You want to see that grow a little bit because their styles are so different. One plays big offense, the other one plays great defense, has ridiculous speed. And so when those two play each other, it's almost like boxing where they say styles make fights. Watching those two play together, really great contrast.
On the men's side, perhaps a clear favorite, 22-year-old Carlos Alcaraz of Spain hopes to win his third straight Wimbledon title. Of course, there is Novak Djokovic of Serbia, perhaps the greatest player of all time. He's 38. What is this, his final chance at a Wimbledon title?
38-year-old legs. Who would you rather bet? Would you go for 21-year-old legs or 38-year-old legs? Novak Djokovic is the great Djokovic. He's got 24 majors. He's done everything you could possibly do on a tennis court. But this is usually when they retire. But Novak has said he wants to play until 2028. He wants to defend his gold medal from the Olympics. He wants that 25th major. He wants that 8th Wimbledon. But there are two great players standing in the way. One, of course, is the world number one, Jannik Sinner. And the other one, of course, is the 2-time defending champion, Carlos Alcaraz. It's a hard road. It's a tough road. And he's got a really, really difficult draw because if everything holds and we don't get any upsets on this, he's got to beat Sinner and Alcaraz to win the championship. So it's a tall order. It's if anyone can do it, Novak can. He's so great at that tournament. But if we're really being honest, this is one of the reasons why these guys don't play as they're pushing 40. Tough ask.
NBA Commissioner Adam Silver says the league is going to study what seems to be a recent spike in Achilles tendon injuries when Oklahoma City won their first NBA championship. But the best player on the Pacers, Indiana Pacers, Tyrese Haliburton, tore his right Achilles tendon during the game. Jason Tatum of the Boston Celtics suffered the same kind of injury during the playoffs. What's going on?
And let's not forget Damian Lillard with the Bucks before that. And so, and also, let's just add baseball to it as well. Thursday night, Griffin Canning, the pitcher for the Mets, he throws a fastball and then suddenly limps off the mound. And he's out for next season and maybe, you know, into 2027 as well. He tore his Achilles. A lot of the questions here have been, is it all bigger, faster, stronger coming down on the human body? Is it too much? Mm-hmm. As you know, we've got more and more and more basketball, more longer seasons. and the muscles get bigger, but the tendons don't. And so there's a lot of questions going on across sports that maybe it's just all too much in the body. The body is waving the white flag. And then there are other folks, of course, who will say, well, these are just sort of just a freak spate of injuries. But if there's one thing we know, they call it an Achilles for a reason. This is not the injury you want. Really, really devastating, especially with these young players under 30.
Howard Bryant, thanks so much for being with us. Talk to you soon, my friend.
Yeah, my pleasure, Scott.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. Minnesota family and friends are gathered for the funeral of State Representative Melissa Hortman and her husband, Mark. Prominent politicians are also there. Of course, the Hortmans were killed in their home 2 weeks ago by a man authorities say posed as a police officer. The gunman is also accused of wounding a state senator and his wife and planning other attacks. This comes as concern has grown over political violence in recent months, including the attempt on President Trump's life. Yesterday, the Hortmans lay in state in the Minnesota Capitol building. Minnesota Public Radio's Catherine Richard was there. Catherine, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
What was that scene like as people came to pay their respects?
You know, the Minnesota Capitol sits on this big hill in St. Paul, and thousands of people were lined up across the sweeping front lawn, and that line snaked around the building as well. Hortman was a prominent Democrat here, but she was also known for being a political bridge builder. Visitors who came paused at two caskets surrounded by potted trees and ferns, one casket for Melissa Hortman, the other one for her husband, Mark. And in between them was an urn, which holds the ashes of their golden retriever, Gilbert, who was also killed. The Hortmans adopted Gilbert after he failed to graduate from a service dog training program, and it's really moved people here. Service dogs cycled in and out of the rotunda to keep watch over Gilbert yesterday.
Tell us about some of the people who showed up.
You know, they came from all corners of the state, and even a few traveled from other parts of the country. Former President Joe Biden came to pay his respects. Minnesota Governor Tim Walz and his wife were there, as well as many legislative leaders. But there were also plenty of ordinary people in line, and that included Brianna Halloran, who came from St. Cloud. That's about an hour and a half away. She was with her three kids, who each held a red rose.
I'm a single mom. I'm a working mom. We're low income. You know, my kids go to a Title I school, and I just want them to recognize that there's always someone behind the scenes working for Minnesotans, and we want to honor that today.
Halloran said that Hortman's policies like paid family and medical leave and free school lunches have had a direct impact on her family.
A lot of lawmakers are rattled by these shootings, and not just in Minnesota. How are people there feeling about the political violence we've seen recently?
Yeah, this is certainly a theme that's come up over and over in the last couple of weeks. And it's something that former Minnesota State Representative Jennifer Schultz, she's a Democrat, brought up with me as she waited in line to pay her respects.
Now a lot of people don't want to run, not just because of threats, but just because of the chaos and the polarization and really the disrespect of working in government, because so many people have put forward this negative view of government, but people need to realize that government is people. It is us, all of us.
She said that she's worried the shootings will create a chilling effect on people wanting to run for office or even participate in the democratic process.
The funeral is getting underway there with people gathered. What do we know?
It's a private funeral at the Basilica of St. Mary in Minneapolis, but it's also being live streamed. Governor Tim Walz and a family friend are speaking, and former President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are attending. The service is a capstone on a shocking and tragic 2 weeks for Minnesotans.
That's Minnesota Public Radio's Catherine Richard. Thank you so much for being with us, Catherine.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
As
As a teen, he played the accordion at Louisiana house parties. Later, he'd inspire musicians from Mick Jagger to Lucinda Williams.
When you hear something like Clifton Chenier, something that's powerful and deep and soulful, you can tell this music is coming from a real person and a real place in their heart.
Honoring the King of Zydeco, Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Noor Rahm with these headlines. Hundreds of thousands of people lined the streets of Tehran today for the funeral procession of top Iranian commanders and nuclear scientists. They were killed during the 12-day war with Israel. Senate Republicans have released an updated version of President Trump's tax cut and spending bill. It includes $25 billion for rural hospitals affected by cuts in Medicaid. Senate leaders hope to begin voting today. And the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration says Stellantis is recalling more than 250,000 vehicles. The problem involves an improperly sealed side curtain airbag that could increase the risk of ejection or injury. I'm Noor Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at progressivecommercial.com. And from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. With a docking location in central Paris, Viking is dedicated to bringing curious travelers closer to destinations across France. Learn more at Viking.com. This is NPR.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Meg Medina's new novel begins with a splash and a shock. A gust of wind tears 13-year-old Graciela Lima off a cliff. She crashes into the water and is sucked down to the very bottom of the sea.
When she finally awakened 100 years later, Graciela sat up, shocked at the dark water all around her and at her own now translucent skin. Hagfish, writhing like eels, sucked away the last morsels of meat from what was left of her bones. There wasn't even time to scream before she heard a voice in the darkness. "Don't be afraid," it said. "I'm Amina."
And that's when Graciela's afterlife, or is it another life, begins. Graciela in the Abyss is the new novel for young readers from Meg Medina, winner of the Newbery Medal and a former national ambassador for young people's literature. She joins us from Richmond, Virginia. Meg, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, a pleasure to be here.
Graciela awakens as a kind of sea ghost. Is that like a mermaid in a Pirate of the Caribbean?
Not really. It was interesting. I was trying not to do the mermaid trope, so to speak, with sea stories. I really wanted this to be a collection of spirits, all kinds of people who end up in the watery depths to begin the next phase of existing. When you die in this book, in the world of Graciela in the Abyss, you sleep for 100 years and then you awaken and assume a job, a role in the sea that helps keep the world in balance. And in Graciela's case, she is a glacier. She turns broken, forgotten things, trash, into beautiful pieces of sea glass for kids to find and others to find on the seashore.
Meg, did you, and I apologize in advance for the term, did you hesitate over such a grave beginning for young readers?
I always do. I always do when I'm going to write hard things for children that involve death or suffering or intense evil. Although the characters are ghosts for the most part, it's really a book about living and what kinds of people we choose to be as we move through community and friendship. So when I started this novel, you know, she does fall off the cliff, she dies, but I wanted to focus on how she chose to live afterward. The other thing that's really ironic is that death is the one constant, right? It's true for all of us. And so I try not to tiptoe around those things with kids. I like to tell them the truth.
I have read that this novel has been a part of your life and work since 2010.
Yes, I meant it to be my sophomore novel. And I tried so hard to write it, but I kept writing the first 50 pages over and over again. I couldn't really find the story. But, you know, I think a book happens in its time. In 2013, my mom passed, and it was a really difficult passing. And suddenly, the notion of regrets and death and all of those things came bubbling forward. And then I found my way into the novel. I found the story that I really wanted to tell. This book, I think, taught me the most about being a writer in that sense, because we think sometimes we write something, it doesn't work, that we failed. Sometimes it's really just a matter of putting it away for a long while and letting the back of your mind sort of puzzle with it.
Speaking of afterlife, I gather you have a name on your file of ideas.
Yes, it's called The Graveyard. And I go back to it, I pick through it like a bone digger. And sometimes it's for the smallest things. It might be the name of a character or a street or that one sentence that my editor said, oh, it's too flowery, but I really loved it and couldn't bear to press delete on. I just keep all kinds of things there. And then I go back and I see if I could give it another life, just like Graciela.
She becomes very useful in the life of a youngster who's, I'll put it this way, still a landlubber, if you please.
Mm-hmm. Jorge. They're both working against lots of regrets and difficulties in their own existence. Jorge with these utterly terrible parents and a legacy. He comes from a family of blacksmiths, and they have fashioned a most terrible harpoon that has now fallen into the wrong hands, a harpoon that threatens the balance of the world. And he finds that he and Graciela have to work together. I loved the friendship between them and the fact that both of them make so many mistakes, which is one of the things I love about kids in general. They make loads of mistakes. And there's a way back. It's not that you make mistakes. It's how you fix them, how you move on from them. And so it was fun to watch these two figure out literally how to be in the same space together and also how to work for a common good.
Meg, I have to ask you a question in your capacity as the 2023-2024 National Ambassador for Young People's Literature. Do you worry about young people reading and seeing so much stuff just flash by on screens?
I do. I think one mistake we've made is that we allowed reading to become, quote unquote, just a subject at school. And we've gotten away from the joy of giving kids choice about what they're reading, giving them time during the day to read, focusing them on the notion of like reading as enjoyment, as escape, as a way to figure yourself out and other people. And that really comes by giving kids a lot of great books and a lot of freedom in choosing what it is they want to read.
Last question, I hope you don't mind. If you were to be a sea ghost, what kind do you think you'd be?
I think I would want to be the kind of sea ghost that dances to move the currents. I've always secretly wanted to be a dancer. My genetics didn't work that way, but I would love to be one of the ghosts that moves the currents and does it gently and just keeps everything moving along.
Meg Medina, her new book, Graciela in the Abyss. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, it was a delight. Thanks so much. Happy reading.
Willie Carlisle says the songs in his new album are full of cowboys, dreamers, misfits, and weirdos. Joshua Donkey.
I'm awfully alone, I'm rarely lonely. The open road's my one and only. The nightly cold comes on so fast. True love truly doesn't last.
Winged Victory is the title of Willie Carlyle's fourth album. Also, maybe the name of that donkey. He's known for blending country with traditional folk music and weaving between the absurd and the sentimental. He also plays about half a dozen instruments. Willie Carlyle joins us now from Kansas City. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me. It's an honor to be here.
When I met a mule named Beauty in the state of old Missouri, and a donkey named Winged Victory in the state of Arkansas.
Tell us about Winged Victory. Donkey, personal friend?
You know, donkey, personal friend, and maybe just a dream that I had. I was at the Smithsonian Folklife Festival with a bunch of friends playing a bunch of Ozark traditional tunes. I was being a true bad folklorist in that I was drunk on moonshine, but also was taking copious notes. And somehow in my notes ended up donkey named Winged Victory, question mark. And I just thought it was so funny later that I had to write a song about it.
But I sang to the dementia ward, and the old folks all sang back.
Are you in what you call your full chest voice on this album?
Absolutely, yeah. It sort of verges from singing like a drag queen at a vaudeville show to what I would call a delicate whisper. I learned to sing by being in choirs in Kansas and in rural Illinois, and then also by calling square dances. So I got a big voice and a little one, and both of them get used for sure on this one.
This album has both original songs and covers. Tell me, please, about one of the covers. We have fed you all for 1,000 years.
We have fed you all for 1,000 years, and you hail us still unfed.
It's the first folk song I really fell in love with. It's an IWW folk song. It comes from the early 20th century, a time when workers wanted to coexist with other wild leftist movements, when Zapatistas and miners might be sharing the same pamphlets, where there were attempts to link the goals of the global working class against global oligarchs and robber barons, and trying to make sense of a material history of exploitation through songs. It's a lofty goal, and as much as any one folk song could, I think that the song manages that goal.
Come and reckon our dead by the forges red and the factories where we spend. Oh, if blood be the price of your cursed wealth, good God, we have paid it in.
I first heard it when I was a teenager from the great anarchist folk singer Utah Phillips, and it kind of started me down a pathway of learning about these working class folk songs, and in a world of big cowboy hats and bad politics, learning about people that were about kindness, unification, and equity for all people.
You want to create music for and with working class people, I gather.
Yeah, I kind of believe that a folk singer should be a dreamer with a long memory. I believe that we need folk singers on street corners and in small clubs. I don't think we can stop singing the news any more than NPR can stop doing the news. I think that's been a folk singer's task for a long time, is to make the news into song, to listen to everyone.
Oh, turn away, young Magdalene. Morning's on the rise.
Our crack research staff has brought me what they discern to be a list of the instruments you play. I'm going to rattle them off. Please tell me if I've missed something, okay? Guitar, banjo, fiddle, harmonica, accordion, concertina, and bouzouki. I think of that as a Greek instrument.
Yeah, you know, true to this kind of pan-American or even global ideas about folk music, the bouzouki was adopted by Irish folk musicians and then has traveled around the world. So we take the ashes of a garden and we use it to fertilize the next one, you know.
We hear the bouzouki in Wildflowers Growing?
Mm-hmm.
bad TV and frozen food in a house we can't afford. The neighbors with bad politics are lonely folks, I'm sure. I want to know a weed from a chestnut tree and a friend from a foe. But nobody knows the names of wildflowers anymore.
What made the bouzouki the instrument you wanted in this case? What steers your choices in any of these songs?
I try to let the instrument do the work. I think it was the great vaudeville banjo player, Uncle Dave Macon, who said, there's no money past the fifth fret.
I'm gonna remember that the next time we go on a little bit in our reports.
Right. I have kind of come to believe that. Simple is hard, simple is good. So I play a lot of instruments, but I would never claim to be an expert at any of them. I love them, especially in folk context, because I get to let them speak very simply and kind of see what they have to say about the words that I'm working with and about the melody that I'm working with. In this case, with Wildflowers, I was using one of my quietest voices.
I'll be there if you care, watch wildflowers grow.
So a sweet, double-coursed lute that sounds like a big mandolin was the right choice.
Come on by and waste some time watching wildflowers grow.
Tell us about the inspiration for your song, Sound and Fury.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked.
Dip my toes in the boiling water, sip sugar from the udder of an angel, purse my lips for the sound and fury, signifying nothing, signing na 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 na.
I always thought about that line from Macbeth, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. And I just thought, what if it's signifying nothing and it's great? What if it means nothing and that is wonderful?
We should explain, I mean, Shakespeare, the line is, as I recall, it is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
Right. And so I guess I just thought of myself as the idiot. And what a joy it is to be the idiot.
Shakespeare will tell you the idiots often say the wisest things, don't they?
Right, exactly.
Born a lollygagger, so baby, I'm shook. I'm studying the art of the ornery stinker, looking for a good word in a good book. No bad jokes, but a whole lot of thinkers. Well, I told you I was working on a building.
I wrote it having a good time with my bandmates and immediately thought that it should be a four-part bluegrass gospel-style song. If you're going to try to make something new out of something old, why not use the old good stuff, right? A genre that has been notoriously serious about its religiosity, and instead slap some Shakespeare on it and try to be an idiot about it. Try to find joy in what sometimes feels stodgy, even if it's beautiful.
Willie Carlisle, his new album, Wing Victory, out now. Thank you so much for being with us.
It's a huge honor. Thanks for having me.
A bitter morning, the sun is dope sick, and all the world is tied up for its fix. At the casino, we're all the scene girls, say they don't mind turning tricks.
And this is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Love grew 10 feet tall in the time you were away.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Made in Cookware. Made in Cookware is crafted by chefs for use in restaurants and home kitchens around the world. Their cookware can be found at madeincookware.com. From the Cy Sims Foundation, partnering with organizations and people since 1985, working for a better and more just future for all. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
long and so blue. But I'll always dream